Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, and certainly not out of his depth, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
Hey, nice.
Thank you. We actually have a first for Tech Stuff to introduce. This is our very first audio request. We had a fan send this in, so let's play the audio request from Nate.
Hey guys, this is Nate calling in from London. I just thought you'd like to know that one night a couple of weeks ago, I spent 2 hours less sleeping because I was too busy reading about submarines. It was the day that Richard Branson announced Virgin Oceanic, which is the mission to send a special one-man submarine to the deepest parts of Earth's oceans and see what's down there and have a play, I guess. But the submarine just fascinated me. It's an amazing piece of tech from what I've read. And really, the idea of sending a person to those depths hasn't been done for decades and certainly hasn't been done with any kind of modern technology involved. And I thought that would make a pretty awesome topic for a show. So here's hoping you might do that one day. Love the show. Speak to you later.
All right, guys. That was Nate. Actually, we have to tell everyone who Nate is.
Yeah, typically we don't use last names when we talk about...
This is a celebrity. Not just an audio request, but a celebrity audio request. This guy is phenomenal. It is Nate Langson.
Yes, he is a tech journalist hero.
Yeah, formerly of CNET, current editor of Wired.co.uk, snazzy dresser, perfectly coiffed.
Oh yes.
Fan of death metal. Nate is a man of many facets. I'm not even joking. You should follow his Twitter feed sometime. You'll find listings of bands that I never knew existed.
Yeah.
I'm a punk rocker. He's a thrasher, right? Super cool guy. Nate, thank you so much for sending that in. And this is our 301st episode, so it's a new era with Tech Stuff. We thought we would tackle this topic. So we're talking about deep sea exploration, and we're going to talk about the Deep Flight Challenger particularly. But before we do, let's talk about kind of the history of deep sea exploration.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it's not been... this is certainly not a technology that's been around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Oh, wait. You mean it has been around for a few hundred years?
Basic. Well, if we talk about the very basic technology, yeah, it's been around for a few centuries. But even then, we're talking about some pretty limited exploration. So back in the day, which was a Thursday, it's just weird, right? But back in that Thursday, back in the ancient times, essentially people thought, all right, oceans have life in them. That's clear. We could see the life. We fish. We get fish. But in general, people thought, well, the deeper you go, the less life you were bound to encounter until you reached a point where there's just no life, right? You get to a certain depth and nothing is living down there. And by the time you hit the ocean floor, it's just essentially a desert, a lifeless desert. That was the thinking until probably about the 17th century. But one of the earliest forms of technology to test, to kind of figure out how deep the ocean was, came out of the days of the Vikings. And that was a sounding weight.
A sounding weight.
Yeah. Which is pretty much what it sounds like. It was a weight tied to a line, and you would lower the line over the side of a boat until you hit the bottom. And then you would draw the weight back up to the surface, and you would measure how long the line was, and that would tell you how deep the ocean was. And back in the earliest days, the way that you would measure this is a sailor would hold the line out between his arms. So he'd stretch his arms out, and one length of that would be a fathom.
That's hard for me to fathom.
Right.
And you know why?
Why is that?
Because it seems like that would be different for every sailor.
Yeah, the average is around it's like a 6 foot length total. That was essentially what a fathom was. So not truly a standardized measure, right? Because it was based upon whoever happened to be holding the line. And if you had Stubby McGee doing it, well, then you're going to have a lot more fathoms than if Stretch over there was measuring out the line. But so not an exact science, but it was getting there, right? It was at least an attempt to measure how deep the ocean was. And of course, we've heard the term fathom before and things like 20,000, or that's leagues. What am I doing? I don't even know what I'm talking about. Chris, you got to stop me before I do that.
Actually, when I think of fathom, I think of the really, really, the game for the Atari 2600. I was going to say really, really bad, but no, actually a lot of people like it.
Yeah.
It was just very simple. In which you're a dolphin.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, I was thinking of the thing that was messing me up was I was thinking of a different Disney film than 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh, which one were you thinking?
Little Mermaid. They sing about the fathoms below.
Fathoms below.
Yeah. See, that's the problem is that I'm thinking about – I've got a vacation planned where I'm going on a Disney vacation, and Disney has taken over my entire world right now.
Well, are you going under the ocean though?
No, I'm not going to go under the ocean, but we're going to talk about going under the ocean. Let's skip ahead from the Viking days to that 17th century that I was talking about before.
Okay.
That was that was around the time of the first submarine. And I say debatably because it all depends upon whom you ask about when the first submarine was created and how viable it was. But, there was a Dutch inventor, Cornelius van Drebbel.
Okay.
He created one that was a wooden frame sheathed in leather. It had oars sticking out the side. It had very close-fitting leather flaps sealing the holes that the oars went through.
Uh-huh.
And was designed to go underwater, and he tested it in the Thames. Supposedly,
really?
King James I himself did a test ride on it.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, that's got to be like... This very well may be an apocryphal story because you think, would the King of England and Scotland put himself at such risk as to be in an underwater, a submersible vehicle in first of all, in the Thames? Have you seen the Thames?
No.
Oh, I have. A few times. It's a lovely place. Anyway, you wouldn't want to be underwater there. So,
I know if the King did go in the submarine, I know why he would want to.
Why is that?
So he could see whales.
Oh, nice. Nice. You know what? And we should also point out, of course, if you didn't hear from Nate's accent, he is, of course, British. So he's getting all these Anglophile jokes that we're throwing out.
So, but no, I'm sure a lot of people know of the Revolutionary War story here in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is not going to make the people from the UK very happy, maybe. I don't know. Well, I guess it's all water under the bridge. But
they're glad to be rid of us now.
Yeah, really. So a lot of people probably remember that there was a very rudimentary submarine used in the Revolutionary War between England and what would be later the United States, the English colonies.
Right.
You know, I'm going from memory, but I'm pretty sure it was very simple, and I think it only used a spear.
Yeah, essentially it was designed to ram into enemy ships.
Yes, it did not do very well.
No.
But it does get a page in the history, well, a paragraph in the history books.
Yeah, you also hear about attempts during the Civil War as well. And right around that same time, so, you know, we're talking about wartime applications of submersible vehicles meant to disrupt either trade or wartime ship movements. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, or roughly around the same time, just a few years after the Civil War, you had a ship that was specifically trying to plumb the depths of the ocean and learn more about what is going on deep in the ocean floor. That's around 1872 to 1876. Do you know what ship I'm talking about?
No, I don't, Jonathan. Why don't you tell me?
So we're going to talk about the Deep Flight Challenger.
Right.
Well, the Deep Flight Challenger is named after two things. It's named after the Challenger Deep Trench, which is a very deep trench in the ocean, off in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And it's named after the HMS Challenger.
Okay.
Her Majesty's ship during the reign of Queen Victoria, who sat on the throne for 60 years.
Thorn?
Throne. Sorry. No, it's an anguished English. Have you ever read the book?
No.
Queen Victoria sat on a thorn for 60 years. She so Her Majesty's ship, the Challenger. Now, the Challenger started off as a warship. It was a corvette-class ship.
Yep.
And it was used in various conflicts in various parts of the world, but eventually was converted into a laboratory. It was a floating laboratory. It's English, so I can say it like that.
I'm not saying a word.
And anyway, they covered around 127,000 kilometers. So around 68,000, almost 69,000 nautical miles.
Wow.
And we think of the HMS Challenger as being the first real serious study of deep sea exploration. Okay. And they took samples from the seafloor, and they did essentially the same way. They would lower a weight down into the ocean until it hit, and it would actually scoop up some of the bedding on the seafloor when they brought it back up. They collected specimens of deep sea life that no one had ever seen before at that point.
Wow.
It was the first real serious study of that environment. And since then, various scientists and explorers and adventurers have been interested in really diving down and finding out more about that environment. And I was going to talk a little bit about a couple of other predecessors to the Deep Flight Challenge. For example, the Bathysphere.
I remember the Bathysphere. I can't say the Bathysphere, but I remember it.
Yeah, it was developed in the 30s. By William Beebe and Otis Barton. And they were both from the New York Zoological Society. And it was 4,500-pound hollow steel ball.
Wow. Well,
it was about 5 feet in diameter. And the idea was that you would carry this on a ship. You would use a crane to move it over the ocean and then lower it into the ocean. It was not powered in any way for mobility. You would actually lower it on a cable. Electricity would create the necessary power for the oxygen system within the bathysphere. But in order to circulate the air, whoever was in the bathysphere actually used a handheld palm frond fan to circulate the air. They used chemicals to absorb carbon dioxide and moisture so that way you wouldn't just have a coating of water all over everything inside the bathysphere, and the air wouldn't get stale.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to find a way to scrub the carbon dioxide out of a submersible. That's one of the challenges.
Yeah, I remember the things like diving bells and the diving suits that you always see in the older movies where they have the helmet and the hose, and somebody's up on the ship cranking the hand crank piston driven air pump. So they were pumping air in there.
Like bellows down into,
But,
very similar.
And so you still have to deal with that because you've got to have a source of air.
The first they dropped down to around 3,000 feet down into the ocean, which was pretty deep for the time being. And it was, they saw a lot of animals that had never been observed before. They essentially wrote down everything they saw. Mm-hmm. But again, they couldn't move around. It was just dropping down and then cranked back up and that's it. Later on, I read that, there were some scientists in the 60s who actually used essentially the bathysphere to descend into the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest point in the ocean.
Right.
They didn't go all the way down, but they went, I think, around 35,000 feet down, which is lower than anyone else has ever been before, at least until we see if the Deep Flight Challenger project is a success. There were some other early attempts. There was the bathyscaph, which was designed by a Belgian scientist, Auguste Piccard. Possibly an ancestor of Jean-Luc. And this one was attached to a tank, a free-floating tank, as opposed to attached to a vessel. But same sort of thing. It was lowered down into the ocean. And it had a little bit more freedom of movement than the bathysphere.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Alvin. You may have heard of the Alvin.
Remember the Alvin.
Yeah, that was an early submersible as well that was used for exploration. The Johnson Sea Link. These are pretty funky looking things. They're, if you've ever seen The Abyss, the film The Abyss, you know, they're in those kind of spherical.
I saw it in a theater.
Yeah, yeah. So those things, that's kind of based on that design. There's they're also sometimes called deep rover submersibles. That are operated by the Deep Ocean Expeditions Company.
Right.
So the deep rovers, they also look like the ones that were used in The Abyss. And James Cameron has used those for other projects, not The Abyss specifically, although, again, the vehicles in that movie were based off of this. He used it in Aliens of the Deep, that nature film of deep sea creatures.
He really likes being under the ocean, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Apparently, he's a big fan of that. And he's a customer of, or at least a potential customer of the same company that makes the Challenger. So I guess we can now sort of talk about what the Challenger is. Yes, you had another thing to add?
Well, I mean, I think our listeners probably will recognize that we're leaving out a pretty big step in between, which is, you know, the development from going from like a device like the bathysphere, where you really don't have a whole lot of control, to modern, older and mid-modern submarines.
That's true.
In the development of the 20th century, and we probably should do a separate podcast on that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we're talking about machines that, you know, can store air and have power to stay underwater for long periods of time, some of which, you know, can hold many, many people.
Yeah. Yeah. We should probably talk about the difference between a submarine and a submersible.
I think that would be,
So a submarine is essentially, it's a boat that goes underwater is really what you're talking about. And it's a self-sustaining kind of thing in the sense that it doesn't depend upon a larger vehicle to get around, more than a few, kilometers.
Right.
Right. Like most submarines can go incredible distances, especially the nuclear submarines, because got that nuclear power going. These submarines are capable of traveling vast distances, either submerged or, they can, various forms of travel. They could go either under the water, over the water, not on top of, but, Anyway, the point being that they don't depend on a larger boat to travel around, right? They're not dropped off.
Right. And some of them can stay underwater for weeks at a time.
Yeah. Some of them use a Caterpillar drive.
Yep.
That'd be the Red October.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is sort of a step in between when I think submarines, I'm thinking, like the warships.
Yeah. Yeah.
Large submarines. This submarine that Nate specifically wants to ask about, is a much, much smaller machine.
Yeah.
In fact, it only holds one person.
And this is where we get into sort of the submersible realm.
Right.
Submersibles are it's kind of like the difference between a boat and a ship, right? Yeah. Arguably, you could say a ship is any vessel that's large enough to hold a boat, and a boat is any vessel small enough to fit on a ship.
So a square is a rectangle, but not every rectangle is a square.
Right. So a submersible tends to be part of a, you know, it depends on a mothership.
Yes.
You know, or some other vehicle where it is deployed from that mothership and then can go and explore, but it can't travel vast distances on its own. It's not meant for that.
Right.
And that's the case with the Challenger. It's also the case of other big famous submersibles like the Mir 1 and the Mir 2. Mm-hmm. These were developed by, at one time, the Soviet Union. It's built by a company in Finland. And then when they were finally produced, actually they were purchased by the same exploration company that uses the Deep Rovers. The same one uses the Mir 1 and Mir 2 for exploration. So like I said, it's not the only submersible out there. There's a one built in Japan that was called the Shinkai 6500. Mm-hmm. That one currently holds the record for the deepest submersible exploration, and that one went down to 6,500 meters, thus the 6,500 in the name.
So did they name it after they dove?
Yeah. Yeah, if it had gone just a little further, been the 6501. But yeah, those are famous. We can't not mention them because they are out there, but it's child's play compared to what the Challenger is supposed to do.
You know, when I think of a submersible too, I'm thinking of something that can't go very deep, just because, you know, it's a smaller ship. It's sort of limited in its capacity, but this is a very unique, unique vessel. So the ship was actually commissioned by somebody who is a famous adventurer on his own.
Yeah.
Who sadly is no longer with us in an attempt to set a world record, I believe.
Yeah. 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 You're talking about Fawcett.
Yes, Steve Fawcett.
Steve Fawcett, a billionaire adventurer, he had, back in 2005, was thinking about investing in this potential vehicle that would be able to break all records of deep sea exploration, manned deep sea exploration. And
yes.
In fact, unmanned as well. No unmanned vehicle would go as deep as what he was looking for. He wanted to have something that could go along the bottom of the Mariana Trench and take a look firsthand at this alien world that no one else has ever seen in person.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us have only seen, bits and pieces of it through unmanned vehicle footage. There was one bathysphere journey that did go down that low. So technically a couple people saw it at one level, but they were not able to go all the way down like Fawcett wanted to. And so Fawcett talked to a guy, Graham Hawks. And Graham Hawks is a kind of an engineer, inventor, a marine specialist. Talked to Graham Hawks about the possibility of creating this vehicle. And Graham Hawks is the head of Hawks Ocean Technologies, and he started to work on the deep flight submersibles, and specifically the deep flight Challenger. The sad part of this story is that Fawcett died in 2007 in an airplane crash, and he died apparently just a couple of weeks before they had planned to announce the Deep Flight Challenger and the purpose for this vehicle to explore the Mariana Trench. With his death, the whole project took a massive setback. I mean, it was clearly a terrible tragedy, and also it meant that the driving force that was behind this development was suddenly gone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Fawcett was a champion of adventure and exploration and pushing human achievement to the limits in every venue. And so to lose that evangelist was a big blow.
Yes.
Well, in 2010, a fellow named Chris Welsh, a pilot here, who had was really interested in this project, kind of took up the torch. So in 2010, 3 years after Fawcett's death, Chris Welsh picks up the torch and runs with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He starts to push for the project to start again, and gets the interest of Virgin Oceanic, which is a brand new company.
Yes,
formed by another incredibly wealthy adventurer thrill seeker,
who also happened to be a friend of Steve Fawcett.
Yeah, and this was who Nate mentioned, Richard Branson.
Mm-hmm.
So Branson now has picked up where his friend left off and says, all right, we want to use the Deep Flight Challenger to go on a series of 5 dives.
Mm-hmm.
And why 5? Because he wants to visit the 5 deepest points of each of, well, the deepest point of each of the 5 oceans.
Right.
So that means the Mariana Trench in the Pacific. And then he wants to go to all the other deep points and all the other oceans and do an exploration run. And so the Deep Flight Challenger is his vehicle of choice. So let's talk a little bit about this vehicle and what makes it so special.
Yeah, it is fascinating, I have to admit. It's about 17 feet, 8 inches long,
yep.
12 feet, 11 inches wide, and 5 feet, 7 inches high.
Mm-hmm.
Weighs about 8,000 pounds, and it's actually made of carbon fiber and titanium.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably some other stuff.
Well, if you had
duct tape, maybe.
According to Graham Hawks, if you had made it just from titanium, it wouldn't survive the pressures at 36,000 feet. Because you're talking about massive amounts of pressure, up to around, say, 20,000 pounds per square inch. That's intense pressure.
Yes.
So you have to be able to create a structure that's going to withstand that. And the carbon fibers are extremely resilient. According to Graham Hawks, in one interview I read, I think it was with Popular Mechanics, he talked about how a computer laid that down fiber by fiber to build this structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's meant to withstand that intense pressure. The vehicle can hold up to 24 hours of oxygen.
Yes.
So you could go down for a full day and night, underwater, and you can go from the very bottom of the ocean to the surface in right around 5 hours.
Right.
It can travel up to a 45 degree angle. Mm-hmm. When it's going up or down. So.
Yeah, it should be able to make about 350 feet per minute.
Yeah.
At that angle.
Right, right. And that's pretty interesting. And then one of the key features of this vehicle is that it has wings.
Yes.
It's not like, if you look at a lot of submersibles, they tend to look like tubes, right?
Uh-huh.
With a propeller at one end or some other form of thruster at one end.
Uh-huh.
And there might be a rudder there that helps you guide which direction. But essentially the way that it works is that it has variable buoyancy where it'll allow some water in. And then once it gets to wherever it's going, as its bottom depth, in order to go back up, it has to drop some weights, and then it'll come back up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not terribly sophisticated. You've got something that provides some thrust, and then you control the vector of the thrust through either a couple of different ways. Like, you could have multiple propellers, and then you just, power on the ones that will allow you to turn in the direction you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a rudder. But there's not a whole lot of control there. Hawk's idea was to add wings to his submersible and make it more like a plane so it, quote-unquote, flies underwater.
Yeah.
With one major, major difference from an airplane's wings.
Oh?
They're upside down, like.
Right.
So I guess we need to describe what lift is here.
Yeah. Well, in the case of an airplane wing, if you were to look at it from
a cross cut
of the wing.
Yeah.
You would notice that the bottom of the wing is essentially flat.
Yeah,
it doesn't have any curve, but the top of the wing is more convex.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a half teardrop in a way because the top of it bulges out toward the leading edge of the wing and then tapers off toward the back edge. And what happens in an airplane is the air moving as the air moves over the wing on the bottom, it moves roughly straight across. And on the top, because it has to go around that bulge,
it has further to go in the same amount of time.
Right.
So if you have the same amount of time to go a further distance, that means you're going faster than someone who's, like if you're running a straight line from A to B and I'm running a circuitous line from A to B, and we both have to leave A and arrive at B at the same time, I have to run faster than you to get there.
Yes.
So same sort of thing. The air going over the top is going to be moving faster than the air going underneath. This also creates a difference in air pressure. It's what creates lift. We're oversimplifying, so please don't write in and talk to me about how I'm wrong about this. I've read XKCD. I understand. But that's the basic principle. So with the Challenger, what they've done is the curve part is not at the top. It's on the bottom. And the reason for that is they don't want lift. They want to counteract buoyancy.
So it's basically, instead of, the air pressure difference sucking the plane up,
it's pushing the
submersible down.
Yes.
Except it's water pressure, not air pressure.
Right, exactly. So it's
someone will write in.
Yeah, exactly. It's hydrodynamic, not aerodynamic.
Indeed.
And so all you have to do, I'm really oversimplifying.
Very.
You provide thrust. If you provide thrust and you're moving forward, then the wings do the work of working against the buoyancy and allow you to maintain or dive deeper. Dive deeper. And then the idea being that if you just stop, then your buoyancy is going to start pulling you up. You don't even have to, you don't have to have as much of a power thing to go back up. You still will probably have to drop weights in order to surface, but that's what allows it to travel at these depths. And it kind of apparently controls like an aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense that in this case, because of its design, the ship would have to continue. It would have to stay mobile. It would have to keep moving in order to essentially stay closer
like,
to the
kind of like what we used to say about sharks.
Yes.
And of course, that's not always true. Not all sharks have to move all the time or they drown. But, same sort of basic principle.
But they do swim constantly.
Yeah. So I think this is a super cool idea. I also think it's interesting that there's a patent on this device, by the way. And if you want to look it up, you can. I mean, you can do a free patent search. Google patent search is free. And it's patent number 7,131,389
B1. And that number again is?
7,131,389 B1. And that is that'll show you the patent that talks about this submersible. Now the patent is actually for a series of submersibles, not just the Challenger, because Deep Flight has they don't just make the Challenger. In fact, they make all these crazy submersibles for really wealthy private adventurer types like Branson and Fawcett.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just the Challenger, but a lot of the basic technologies are explained in that patent, including they had to design a very comfortable chair, because if you're going to be going underwater for that long, you want to have a comfortable seat. And this is designed for the non-pilot, it's essentially a civilian adventurer. It's not meant for military use or anything like that. So it has to be comfortable, because most of us don't put up with that kind of stuff.
Right. But it is designed for while it isn't a military vessel.
Yeah.
It is, however, designed to do some scientific work. It's not just about adventuring.
Right, yeah.
Although that part is cool.
They've partnered with some pretty cool people like Scripps Ocean Institute, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, a lot of other scientific organizations. And the hope is that the Challenger will be able to get a real good look at this underwater world that we hardly know anything about and provide some information for scientific purposes. I'm really excited to see exactly how much comes out of this project. And it'll be interesting to see how challenging the Challenger really finds going down to that depth.
It would be a little frightening for me, I think.
Yeah.
To try to go down to that depth, because,
that intense pressure. I mean, yeah. The smallest weakness and that thing it crumples.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And, the controls here are mechanical controls. Like, you move the stick to the left and it mechanically moves the wings so that you roll. It's almost like flying a plane. There's pitch and roll as opposed to, you're not just heading down or heading up or doing a vector-based turn like you would with a regular submersible. It's a fascinating approach, and I'm really hoping that it's a successful one. We'll hopefully be able to find out before too much longer. I mean, again, this project was originally supposed to launch both figuratively and literally in 2007.
Right, and they're anticipating the possibility of going ahead with it in 2011, so it may not be but a few months off.
Yeah, and I'll be excited to see. If it breaks those records pretty much stay broken, because if it can get to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, there ain't no deeper.
Yeah.
Well, where else do you go?
Well, there's a lot of information about it on Virgin Oceanic's website.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you can learn more about the people on the science crew, the people on the surface who are going to be with them at the time. It is interesting to note that while Sir Richard isn't going down to the Mariana Trench, he is going to be piloting one mission himself, the second mission. And I'm just going,
I hear they're actually going to alternate.
Are they going to alternate?
I hear that he's going to alternate. So he does every other one. There's five of them. He'll do. Yeah. So that means if he's doing the even ones, he does two and four.
Yeah.
And so.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are brave, crazy people.
Yeah.
But you need those.
Crazy in a good way.
But, like, if we didn't have these brave, crazy people, think of all the projects that never would have happened.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the space race never would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, all the test pilots who have gone before. All of the pilots who are out there now, I mean, without the test pilots who actually were willing to put their lives at risk to see if this stuff would work the way that everyone thought it was going to work, you know, they wouldn't exist. We'd still be getting around on horse and buggy or dirigible. Oh, that, nice. By the way, that is interesting. That's the way Hawks describes the difference between the Challenger-based, wing-based submersible and the old submersibles. It's like he says, you know, one – the old base submersibles are essentially dirigibles. There's not a whole lot of control, and they're slow and sluggish. And,
yeah.
You know, and this is more elegant, like an airplane.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that patent, by the way, if you do read it, it's funny. It comes across to me as one of the snootiest patents I've ever read. Cause it's like they're little subtle digs at other submersibles all the way through, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
But so Nate. Thank you very much for listening to our show. We really appreciate it. Thank you for the audio request. That was awesome. Hope that this was an interesting discussion. We're really looking forward to seeing more about this and the kind of technology that comes out of this. Because, you know, like, we don't just get biological information from these sort of procedures. We find out new ways to do things better.
Yeah.
So it may be that this is just the first of many deep sea explorations that build on the foundation that's set by the Challenger.
And, you know, with it being one of the Virgin properties, it's only a matter of time before Sir Richard is trying to figure out some way to take tourists down there.
Well, I've already read that he's already invested in other forms of submarine travel that, well, you know, you can buy a ticket to go on these submarine or submersible journeys, although they are not designed to go as deep as the Challenger goes. And in fact, we should also add that while the Challenger sounds really, really advanced, deep flight has not rested. Deep flight has continued to develop submersibles, including I think there's one called the Super Falcon. The Super Falcon is very similar in design to the Challenger, but I think it can actually fit two people, not just one.
Oh, okay.
And it doesn't go as deep as the Challenger does, but it's like a faster, sleeker version of the Challenger, but again, not built to withstand the intense pressure that you would find in a place like the Mariana Trench.
Yeah. Yeah.
Personally, I do want to say one thing to whomever does eventually pilot this first, trip, because you never know, things can change between now and when it launches.
Sure. Sure.
Be careful, because I read a book, and in that book, the Megalodon still exists in the Mariana Trench. And I'm just saying, those sharks are enormous. So you got to be careful when you're down there, because you never know when you run into a Megalodon. Okay? All right. There's a whole book about it.
Okay.
It's called Meg. I consider it a documentary. Just like Jaws.
Yeah.
Yeah, the documentary Jaws. So, guys, thank you for listening. If you have any requests, you can email them to us. That address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or you can let us know on Twitter and Facebook. Our handle there is techstuffhsw. We thank you again, Nate, for your wonderful suggestion. Hope everything's going well across the pond. And we will talk to all of you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready.
Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.